like, what's the demand to hold DAI? And fundamentally, it comes kind of from the differentiation to other stablecoins, right? So when I borrow in DeFi or anywhere in crypto, I always borrow from Maker because it's the most tax efficient and has the best rates, period. Why is USDC growing? Why is USDT growing? But why is DAI really flat for a long time? And I think the yield itself, it cannot just be the answer.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of ZeroX Research. March is just around the corner, and I wanted to make sure to give you a quick reminder to not top tick your prices of your DAS London tickets. If you use codes 0x10 at checkout, you can lock in a 10% discount on your ticket. Don't miss out on your chance to get ahead of the curve. I'll see you in London.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of ZeroX Research. We have an awesome episode lined up today. Got a little bit of an all-star cast. We got Brick co-hosting with Mark from Stakehouse, Vance from Framework, and Hasu, who needs no introduction. Today is Friday, March 1st, as of recording. And as a reminder, you can use code 0xresearch10 at app.blockworksresearch.com for 10% off your annual Blockworks Research subscription. So today we're going to be talking about MakerDAO. Stakehouse put together an incredible report, 50 pages long. Hopefully we can link to it in the show notes for people to read it. But Mark, do you maybe want to kick us off and explain just kind of how MakerDAO works at a high level so the listeners have an idea on that?
Yeah, so Maker is a two-token system, and with MKR being the governance token and DAI being the stablecoin, it was one of the first stablecoins that kind of came on the market, and that's what really caught my attention. I got into crypto in mid-2013 when I saw Bitcoin on CNBC. It was ripping from double digits to triple digits at that time, which was an astronomical move for someone that had only kind of seen equity like returns. And I found the white paper and became super interested in Bitcoin and crypto. Fell a little out of love with it during the hard fork wars with Bitcoin Cash on the big block debates, but then later in 2017 became much more interested in crypto again with discovering about Ethereum. And that kind of Bitcoin journey led me to MakerDAO, where I always knew that a stablecoin would be super important in this ecosystem, just seeing how volatile Bitcoin was. And the common criticism of it was that no one would use it if it was unstable, especially if it's appreciating constantly. You don't want to spend a currency that's appreciating constantly against your native currency. So Maker was one of the few ways to get exposure to that stablecoin thesis at the time. And that thus kind of began my journey with Maker.
Do you maybe want to go into how it works at a high level, just because there's a lot of new people maybe coming into the market who don't fully understand, and Maker's kind of evolved pretty drastically since the beginning. So maybe, the DAI issuance, peg stability, ensuring protocol solvency, those kind of things.
Yep. So DAI is an over collateralized stablecoin. You basically lock up crypto native collateral, unless you did in the first version, and you mint DAI, the stablecoin, against it. The over-collateralization ratios depend on the collateral. The more liquid and stable a particular collateral is, like ETH, SETH, generally, you have lower collateralization ratios. And Maker, charges a stability fee, which is often compared to an interest rate for that. And that's kind of how it accrues value. A lot of the stability fees go to creating a surplus buffer or kind of like a bad debt reserve. So in the event of downward market volatility, when vaults are liquidated, the DAI users are protected because there's cushion to basically absorb that bad debt. Maker started with just ETH as collateral, and it was single collateral DAI, then evolved to multi-collateral DAI, where it could basically use any ERC-20 as collateral. So that basically led to Wrapped Bitcoin being onboard as collateral. And a whole slew of other altcoins and different types of tokens, including UDV2 LP tokens, which are pretty much gone at this stage of the game. But back then, it was kind of thought that you could onboard any type of collateral to Maker at the EOC20 standard. But the reality was is the market's kind of pumped, especially ETH, and gas costs explode. The Oracle cost became super high relative to, you know, the total liquidity of some of these altcoin assets. So now Maker's kind of shifted back into these, you know, blue chip collaterals like ETH, STEETH, and Wrapped Bitcoin. And also, you know, a big theme in 2023 especially was, you know, getting into the real world asset game more heavily.
Yeah, maybe on the topic of real world assets, like, I would be interested to hear everybody's opinion on kind of changing the collateral type to a more like illiquid version, because of course it's easier to sell ETH than it is to sell like these off-chain bonds. Do you guys think that there could be any like liquidity troubles there at some point? And yeah, what's your overall opinions on like Maker going more into these RWAs?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good corollary of this was STEETH back in the day, probably like a year ago. And, you know, I think people were worried pretty much across the board that, you know, there wasn't enough liquidity in the curve pools to absorb any sort of liquidation style cascade of that collateral. And like that just frankly wasn't true. Ditto USDC when it depegged. And I think what we've learned is that there's always kind of a market for various collateral types, as long as they're not like whitelisted. In terms of like only specific people can bid them when things, you know, turn south. And so I'm not particularly worried about them getting into, you know, collateral types, especially on the fixed income side that could get them into trouble. I think there's basically infinite scale and infinite people who would bid that on chain. And, you know, even the larger firms, the larger market makers would allocate significant portions of their balance sheet to something like that if it were to happen. The thing that I'm kind of like most interested in is liquid restaking tokens, LRTs, are going to become very zeitgeisty in terms of collateral that people want to have accepted. When you can yield, like theoretically at least 30 or 40%, and you can borrow at 7, like that's just going to be this natural carry trade that people put on. And I think the LRTs are kind of like this other bucket of, it's kind of hard to tell how much risk they are. It's kind of hard to tell what the slashing conditions are. And it could, you know, get squirrely if there is like this kind of cascading slashing moment. And so I, like, that's kind of more of what worries me over the, you know, medium term is not like, you know, the T-bills, like those are totally fine in my mind, but kind of the other side of the crypto native spectrum.
Yeah, so the solvency, like managing and the solvency and liquidity for Maker is one side of the coin to your question, right, Brick? But the other is, what choice does Maker have? Because when you look at stable coins, then they are fundamentally constrained in two ways, right? They are constrained on the demand side by the interest of people to hold the coin, and on the supply side of the willingness of the people to borrow the coin into existence. And so this is a fundamental concept of all stablecoins that, I mean, we can talk about more, but every single unit of DAI basically, and every single unit of everything, like every stablecoin needs to be borrowed into existence by someone. And when you used to have the situation in the past where when you have more demand to hold the coin than to create it through borrowing, then the coin just depegs upwards, right? And it trades above $1. And this was the case for a long time for Maker. So there was more demand to hold the coin than to create it. And there just isn't enough demand to borrow like a stablecoin into existence only against crypto collateral. So we've seen that, and like we've seen many instances of that. I mean, like no stablecoin that relies on crypto collateral can get to a meaningful network effect, to a meaningful size, right? And so if Maker wants to ultimately play kind of in the league with USDC and Tether, then it has to get big, right? Like Maker either gets big or it doesn't make any sense at all, right? And so because money is a network effect. And so in order to get big, it needs to be scalable on the supply side. And the only way you do this is by, you know, accepting as much collateral as you can within the constraints of this really, you know, liquidity and solvency optimization problem.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you think at the point where the protocol is right now, how the T-bills are acquired, where like it takes a few days to maybe move funds to the off-chain entities and then for the off-chain entities to like buy the T-bills, and then let's say there is a situation where the T-bills would have to be sold early to like, because you have so many redemptions. Do you feel that, yeah, this structure that Maker has in place right now, could it scale like 5x, 10x, or do we need some kind of like development on that side?
So, I mean, fundamentally, it should scale fine. What you're describing is kind of the difference between two very important concepts in stablecoins and in banking in general, which is the difference between liquidity and solvency. So solvency means that every unit of DAI that is outstanding is backed by a loan, you know, of like more than 1-to-1 ratio. But the difference to liquidity is that, you know, it cannot necessarily be redeemed right at the moment when you want it, you know, and then you can have the potential for a bank run, leading basically to like sell the bank, lead the bank to sell kind of its assets at fire sale prices. Really this shows us that the main constraint that a bank has is liquidity, right? It's not necessarily solvency. And so what Maker does is it just keeps a bunch of DAI it keeps a bunch of USDC and like assets that it can sell immediately in reserve. So it always needs to kind of manage its expectations of how many people want to withdraw, even in the worst case in a given time period, and have enough money or enough assets liquid to pay out all of these depositors when they come to withdraw. So this is the fundamental constraint that they have, and so far they've done, I would say, a really good job at managing that. And even if there was a case where, let's say, 2 billion DAI wanted to withdraw at the same time, then not everybody can withdraw, but the coin is the solvent, right? It's like, it's just that people may have to wait a little bit, and the coin may also depeg to the downside. So maybe, just people just want out and they want out now, and then DAI trades at 90 cents, for example. But then what you see is, of course, there's like a natural arbitrage here where people know that if they wait 1 week, then they can withdraw it for $1. And so they buy it and, now at a price that's nearly a dollar, and then they can basically realize their profit. So, I mean, I would say as long as the coin is solvent and does like a decently good job at managing its liquidity, then it should be near infinitely scalable.
Yeah, I'd just add that Maker's getting a lot more sophisticated around liquidity as well. You know, historically, it had a tremendous amount of liquidity in the USDC PSM, which for those less familiar with Maker is a peg stability module. Since you swap DAI for USDC at a 1-to-1 peg, kind of as we talked about. But now Maker's kind of optimizing both for liquidity and generating return on the assets and the excess demand for DAI. And essentially what we're doing now is taking on-chain analytics and using that to drive the asset allocation strategy. It's something that is called asset liability management. And we're trying to do this using purely on-chain data. So kind of looking at the liquidity demands of DAI historically, and all the different market factors and assets that we have, their duration basically boils down to looking at like the duration, which is like the liability side of DAI use, and matching that with assets on the asset side. So historically, Maker's been super conservative with super short duration treasuries. It's had a foray into some kind of bespoke, less scalable real asset vaults. Those journeys were like absolutely necessary to kind of get Maker to the point where it could at peak onboard over 2 billion of treasuries. And in terms of like unwinding those treasuries, we're down to like, I think about 1.3 billion in treasuries now through the two primary vaults. And that's just showing that, you can shift that liquidity essentially from treasuries, to, crypto collateral quite seamlessly. And right now it's, you know, at the very beginning of what this is going to look like long term, there's friction, you know, off and on chain. But longer term, you know, we're going to see a huge wave of these tokenized treasury products and tokenized money market funds. And that's going to make this process almost instantaneous long term. So, you know, Maker's kind of built this, what we call like a dual engine structure, where you have exposure to, you know, RWAs and short duration treasuries during, you know, the bear market periods where crypto rates are lower than UST bills. And then also the crypto collateral loans with the blue chip assets, where you can take advantage of those higher rates during the bull market times like now. So having this like kind of dual structure allows Maker to become much less volatile in terms of like an earning asset, and much more sustainable and resilient longer term.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. I would continue that by saying that, or asking that, this dual structure kind of then relies on the fact that there is demand for DAI, because otherwise, of course, you can't invest into these RWAs and you don't have like crypto backing. What do you feel that will be the like main demand driver for DAI in the next, let's say, 1 to 2 years?
It's pretty obvious, right? It's looping Steeth at the moment, and then looping LRTs in the future. But I mean, maybe this is a good, you know, transition point to Endgame, or we can keep, you know.
Hold on, Vince, because I do want to interject here. So this is not actually the case. So looping is not a use case for DAI, like, because that's, you know, when people just want to like deposit Steve and they want to borrow DAI to buy more Steve, then at the end of that trade, somebody else has to hold the DAI, right? And so that's why DAI really is fundamentally constrained by there must be like a pool of people who want to hold it, right? For some reason, that's not leverage, right? So, and so it's a very good question.
No, I don't disagree with that. And I think a lot of it also boils down to, or at least the demand side is like, is it a PSM model that persists into the future, or is it an AMO model that persists into the future? Is it a hard peg at a dollar as kind of mandated by the PSM, or is it something that floats? Because if it floats and if it, you know, kind of is a soft peg, then there's kind of like this new aspect of demand where, you know, like I think we're probably one of the larger users of DAI today. And we denominate a lot of kind of our at least trading and activity in DAI. And if you're going to sell us 97 cent DAI, like we're going to buy that. And that's kind of like this different source of demand. And so I think it kind of depends a little bit on what the future holds. And Endgame is obviously going to be a large part of that in terms of how people think about the peg and what that means for demand.
Can I ask you a question? Can I take like the interviewer seat for a moment?
Yeah.
So why do you hold DAI over USDC or USDT?
I mean, the difference between DAI and USDC in my mind is just the lending facility. And we're large ETH holders, and it's the fastest, cheapest, most efficient way to borrow. It also has the least tax consequences. And so if we go into Aave and we, you know, put in ETH and we get a ETH back, that's a taxable event for us. DAI and Maker doesn't have that. I think that's probably not super well understood. And when we have cash, we put it in the DSR, you know, and it yields 5%. And so, you know, that's kind of how we currently think of DAI. But, and, you know, I would say we're probably one of the larger users. I don't want to like get too specific into like what our CDP is, but like we're one of the larger users today. There's just really no facility like it. And in the future, you know, with endgame farming, it kind of totally changes the equation as well, where we're going to want more DAI to do this stuff. And as ETH continues to run, like we just have a lot more capital to work with on the DAI side.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is, this is in many ways, I think this is like the most important thing to talk about, which is what's the demand toward DAI? And fundamentally, it comes kind of from the differentiation to other stablecoins, right? And so I'm 110% with you on like the borrow side. So when I borrow in DeFi or anywhere in crypto, I always borrow for Maker because it's the most tax efficient, has the best rates, period, you know. Borrowing DAI is, like, bar none, kind of the best way to get leverage. It's, to me, the demand side, I think, where Maker is really constrained right now, right? And it, I mean, if like 5 billion, like if there was 5 billion DAI more outstanding, then, you know, Maker could easily put it into T-bills as well, right? But they can't, because people don't actually want to hold more DAI than they want right now. And I think it's very interesting to ask, you know, why that's the case. Why is USDC growing? Why is USDT growing? But why is DAI really flat for a long time? And I think the yield itself, it cannot just be the answer, because I can get 5%, 5.5% on my USDC on Coinbase, and I can get 7% on my USDC in Aave. So why should I put it in Maker, right? Like, why should I put it in the DSR? It's like, it doesn't make a ton of sense. So I think the answer must be somewhere else. Like, it must be in the network effect, or in the decentralization, or in the brand, like people feeling more secure in DAI than something else. And this is like a thing that Maker has been neglecting, I would say, now for a long time. Like, they've been very focused on the supply side, and they've been very focused on the governance side. And I would say almost for 2 years, they haven't been focused on the demand side at all. And you can see that in the supply outstanding.
So maybe just like my thought process, at least, and why we bought Maker and you know, why we're bullish on it, is I'd agree with you. The status quo is basically like, the demand is the demand, and, you know, they're rotating from real world assets or T-bills into, you know, crypto denominated back loans. And, like, you know, the rate limiter for how big the protocol can get is kind of like, how much do you want to draw out of the T-bills and use to finance these crypto loans? And so, like, why would you hold DAI going forward? In my mind, why you would hold DAI is to farm Spark, is to get Chronicle tokens, is to get, you know, all of the different sub-DAO tokens that exist today. And, like, you know, you think of it this way. I think, personally, the sub-DAOs will come out around, like, if you add them all up, you know, and all the tokens that will be given to Maker, it's probably going to come out around, like, 4 to 5 billion total. Like, every single token that launches today is launching in a billion. So just, you know, there's five of them, add them all up, 4 to 5 billion. 75% of that will go to DAI holders. So let's, you know, make it, you know, we're going to 4 billion is going to go to DAI holders, and you're going to give 25% of that out a year. So there's, you know, over 4 years. So there's 4 billion, you give out a billion a year to all DAI holders to go farm it. And let's say they farm that at a rate of 10%. So you'll probably have, like, you know, 5 to 10 billion farming a billion of incentives over the first, you know, few years. And, you know, that's doubling the DAI supply. And then it's like a question of, like, can you get into this reflexive flywheel where, like, you're kind of giving out, like, the equity, like, tokens to get the DAI liquidity to go give crypto loans to people, or frankly, T-bill loans. You know, do you do something with the PSM where you transition it into an AMO and you make it more of like a game for people like us? Like, if that game starts, like, we're going to really love to play it, because we can just basically pay off our debt cheaply if it depegs to the downside. Obviously, if it depegs to the upside, we have, like, a different problem, but in an environment of rising DAI supply, that shouldn't really happen. And so, you know, like, I think the line of sight to, like, 10 to 20 billion DAI is pretty clear to me while these sub DAOs are up and kicking, basically. But I think, to your point, like, why do people hold USDC versus DAI? I think a lot of it does have to do with the branding of DAI. DAI just sounds bizarre. And if you have, like, I don't know what the new brand of Maker is or what the new brand of the stablecoin is, but if it's like USD something, I think you're immediately going to get a lot more people that will hold it. And last thing I'll say, I know I've been talking for a little bit. The other thing that I would say is, like, things like Athena and specifically on-chain derivatives, where, like, you think about it like this. Let's say Athena and Maker partnered up, and, you know, like a sub-DAO style relationship where Maker gives DAI to Athena. You know, maybe they even give, like, SDAI to Athena. They use that to go off and, you know, basically on a synthetic style exchange, you know, short ETH, you know, capture that funding rate, like you don't have any like liquidity pressure on DAI. You don't need to sell that. Like derivatives are kind of like this just natural supply sink for stablecoins. I think that could be another avenue of growth and demand for stablecoins broadly on chain. So that's my perspective.
Yeah, I just add like one thing that's really interesting to me about the SubDAO launches is it's one of like the most like fair launch systems that I've kind of seen in my career in crypto. And like what I mean by that is the vast majority of the supply is being emitted through these, you know, front end token farms where you lock up either DAI or MKR. And the only way you can farm this token is by, you know, going down one of those two paths. There's no, you know, pre-sale, there's no, you know, VC investors, there's no, you know, massive insider allocation. It's all being emitted to the community and for people that want to participate in the ecosystem. And as Vance mentioned, like there is a, I think, quite a reflexive nature of, you know, you need DAI or MKR to farm this, these tokens, which, you know, if Vance's estimates are right, is going to put a ton of buy pressure and upward pressure on DAI's peg, which will lead to USDC inflows, which will be used to either, you know, subsidize, you know, crypto collateral lending or put into US treasuries. So, you know, and then you have higher cash flows from that higher DAI supply that's being allocated. So there could be somewhat of a, you know, significant growth through this process, but you know, a lot of the details are kind of still being worked through, and it's kind of, you know, we're not sure what the exact form will look like. We've put a lot of detail in the report around the existing envisioned structure for how the tokens will be emitted. But there's a lot of thought being put into kind of, you know, how the value will flow kind of back and forth between MKR and the new SubDAO tokens. Because on one hand, like a lot of this revenue was going to Maker Core as it is today, will be going to, you know, the SubDAOs in the future. But, you know, to offset that, you have, you basically require owning Maker to farm this effectively or die, right? So I think that'll kind of offset any, you know, price pressure from, you know, people wanting to get exposure to the SubDAOs by, you know, kind of being required to own MKR or die to get involved.
Well, one last thing is that there's going to be Maker inflation too. I think it's like 3% or something, or maybe a little bit more than that. But like, you know, you can think of it as SubDAOs come out hot, people are farming them. Say there's like, you know, 10 or 5 billion more DAI farming them. You've got 10 billion of DAI earning at about 6% per year. So that's 600 million. You know, you net the DSR out of that. You net all the costs out. Like you're probably like 300, maybe 400 million of revenue at that point, or of earnings at that point. That goes back to buying the Maker token. It goes higher. The inflationary rewards are worth more, you know, that are going to DAI farmers, just like the Maker inflationary rewards. So like, a lot of the end game plan is to, like, in my mind at least, to make this reflexive. And you can kind of think of it as like kind of like restaking, where it's like all these AVSs, you know, they're going to give tokens to ETH holders, and you know that'll do something for Eigenlayer, and it'll be like all these things are kind of all kind of the same to me at least. And it's just a matter of like who has the best kind of like SubDAO tokens. And Spark alone is like eighth on DeFi Llama at this point. If that keeps growing, like that's going to be a seriously valuable protocol. And it's just like amazing that Maker has that in their ecosystem.
What's up, everyone? March is approaching fast, and I want to give you another reminder not to miss out on DAS London. It is coming. It's right around the corner, and it's in March from the 18th to the 20th. We have 3 full days of content. This is your chance to bump shoulders with some of the world's top executives and have open dialogue with both attendees and speakers. We're going to be focusing on a range of topics that I'll let Ren discuss for you.
First on the list, we have Bitcoin Catalyst, the halving and spot ETF. Next, we have a view from the buy side from investors on things like strategy, portfolio allocation, and more. We also have a topic on RWA's tokenization and stablecoins, which I think we can all agree are going to play a large role in crypto's future. We'll also talk about global regulatory frameworks like compliance best practices and the evolution of global standards that are shaping the global investment landscape. We'll also have someone from the institutional front to talk about infrastructure such as banking and payments with financial giants like Visa and JP Morgan. And last on the list, the macro case for digital assets. So don't miss out on this morning monumental event, seats are limited, so be sure to register today by hitting the link in the description and using the promo code 0x10 to save 10% on tickets. See you in London.
I think that'd actually be a good spot to maybe start more high level on the end game plan. Maybe Mark, since you wrote this really comprehensive report, you can start there, because I think a lot of people are still confused about what actually is the end game.
Yeah, sure. And I guess I'll just brief this by saying I am in no way a Maker endgame expert. It's constantly evolving. And even what we wrote in the report is, you know, likely to kind of change as, you know, the endgame continues to evolve and iterate. I know there's like a lot of thinking, kind of like steelmanning about how we can make this, you know, even better, more sustainable, more resilient, more scalable. So, you know, take everything I say with a grain of salt. But high level, as Maker dissolved the foundation in mid-2021 and transitioned to the DAO, there were a number of teams that basically spun up as independent contributors called core units. And I think kind of what ended up happening and leading to the end game was there was kind of a lot of fighting over resources politically. And I think Roon kind of saw this and wanted to create a better system to align incentives with value creation in the Maker ecosystem. So, you know, part of that is by continuing to innovate. And that's you know, sometimes at odd with decentralization, because to innovate, you need to be centralized, you need to move quickly, you need to make decisions fast. And you know, Maker as a decentralized protocol is all about, you know, kind of moving slowly and not, you know, taking too risky decisions too quickly. So it's kind of created this, Roon's kind of created this new model where you start to ossify and simplify the core and push the innovation to the sub-DAOs where they can, you know, kind of be like testing grounds and almost like, you know, pure types of allocation strategies. So Spark, you see, you know, the money markets protocol, you know, based off of Aave V3, but they've got, you know, a ton of new exciting features in the pipeline that the team over there is super excited to unveil. And I think some people are kind of, you know, downplaying what Spark is doing, even with the massive TVL growth that Vance mentioned. They've got, you know, a very top tier team. And I think they're going to surprise a lot of people going into the back half of this year and next year. And also on the sub-DAO side, there's the RWA sub-DAOs, and they're going to have a lot more autonomy and flexibility to do interesting and I think very value creative deals for MKR. But essentially, this is supposed to kind of, you know, it does add complexity now, especially with all the rules and stuff being created, all the tokenomics and value flowing back and forth. But long term, the idea is basically, you know, simplify, ossify, make a core, push innovation to the edges, and then, you know, scale successful innovations and creative products that actually end up working to continue to grow the Maker ecosystem.
There's also something in there about the MKR token and like value accrual redesign. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, Maker is basically kind of underwriting the sub-DAOs. It's extending, you know, essentially like a line of credit through dime minting. And the sub-DAOs would basically have to follow certain rules outlined in the stability scope, which is one of the five kind of core scopes of the endgame plan. And so, you know, I think Maker kind of like is giving away some value, quote unquote, because, you know, you're emitting the vast majority of these new tokens to the community, right? So that value, though, is kind of staying in the ecosystem because the sub-DAOs are incentivized to own MKR LPs, like MKR paired with the sub-DAO token called Elixir. And so there's going to be buyback pressure from the sub-DAO MKR pair into sub-DAOs. And that'll lead to more, I think, value accruing back to MKR. But again, like a lot of the kind of value flows are, I think, still being finalized. But I would definitely encourage anyone that owns MKR to kind of understand how the tokenomics work. And if they have feedback, you know, get engaged in the community, because, you know, everyone in the community is trying to work towards making this more, you know, sustainable and scalable. Obviously, there's some, you know, risks. We don't want it to be like too boom bust. We want it to be, you know, booming and sustainable growth. So, yeah, hoping that a lot, we wanted to bring a lot more visibility to kind of what's going on with Maker in this report to kind of lower the barrier to entry to participating in the end game, which is, I think, raise temporarily the barrier to entry in Maker. You know, DAOs are already super complex places to operate. And, you know, one of kind of our missions at Stakehouse is to pioneer open and transparent finance. And a big part of that is the transparency, visibility into what's going on with these big DAOs and protocols, and, you know, lowering the barrier to entry to participation. So we want DAOs to actually be successful long-term. Like, we need more broad and diverse opinions and engagement in the DAOs.
Yeah, I kind of want to zoom in on the whole sub-DAO structure because, or actually this goes out to Hasu. I know you've been quite vocal about the structure maybe having some inefficiencies or other problems. Would you like mind kind of zooming in on that then?
Yeah, sure. So I've been a vocal critic of the endgame plan, I would say. But I want to caveat that by saying that I've been an MKR holder for a long time, and I'm still a significant holder, and so I'm overall like very bullish on the project and its potential. It's just that I don't agree with everything that kind of happens, and so Mark was basically giving, I think, a very good representation of what are really the positives of the endgame plan. So creating kind of a narrow DAO at the core that's easier kind of to oversee and easier to manage and easier to secure. I think that's very positive, and pushing innovation to the edges. So that's the part that I really strongly agree with, I would say. I think the downsides of the plan and how it was executed is basically four different things. So I think one, it actually has been creating more complexity rather than simplify. And so this might be a temporary thing, right? But as of today, I think, you know, endgame is extremely difficult to understand. And I think it just ends up increasing kind of the complexity of the project and, you know, increase the risk surface. Number two, as a result of this huge overhaul, I think it really like slows down the protocol in many ways, right? There's many things that could have been built that haven't been built because Maker is so inwardly focused on governance instead of outwardly focused on its users. And so that's going back to the point that I was making earlier, that for 2 years, Maker hasn't really been focused on DAI holders at all. So they turned on the DSR, great, okay. But that's like a one-line change, you know. There's a million things that could be done to make DAI more liquid, more accepted, make it more useful, for example, as like a payments vehicle or savings vehicle, or make it easier to buy for different like groups of users, etc. All of these things that could have been done that haven't been, because now we are focused on the end game instead. So that's, I think, the opportunity cost of it. And number three is, I would say, the way that it was done, because kind of the end game, I mean, Maker is a very vibrant community. It's probably like after, in terms of on the application layer, I would say it's the app that has kind of the most diverse and most decentralized and most vibrant community of people who really strongly care about the project and kind of want to work at it. And the way that the kind of the endgame was executed kind of politically, the way that it was voted on, not necessarily like to anyone's fault, but it was very controversial, I would say. And it ended up pushing out a lot of community members and basically fracturing the community. And then the final one is like, I'm not a big fan of actually creating like all of these sub-DAOs and like sub-DAO tokens. To me, it seems like it creates a lot of unnecessary risk for a project that's operating like on people's savings. And so I think when you want to be like the most decentralized and conservative stablecoin, then one of the last things that you should do is like launch like a ton of speculative tokens for people to gamble on. So I know that I have a very kind of unusual opinion about that, but yeah, that's why I think roughly speaking, why I'm on the more skeptical side.
Vance, do you have anything to add on the endgame? Any opinions?
No, I mean, frankly, like we kind of got in after we bought our maker before, after kind of all the political machinations happened. And yeah, I can't speak to any of that. I do think like process of elimination, how do you grow DAI? You know, there's not infinite ways. And tokens and subDAOs that are successful are basically, in my mind, kind of like the only way to increase DAI liquidity, or at least, you know, like real liquidity for DAI to fund either crypto loans or RWAs. And like, I think the end game plan is pretty coherent, and it's just like a summation of lessons from prior cycles. It's like redenomination will get more people more excited about, you know, Maker, which will cause it to go up, and you know the inflationary rewards are worth more. Okay, check. You know, it probably needs a new brand. Maker and DAI doesn't make a ton of sense, and nobody wants to hold a stablecoin that doesn't have USD in the name. All right, that makes sense too. It's like subDAOs, you know, like giving away tokens. As I said, it's like the best way to grow this ecosystem. And I think also in the same way that you see people like gravitate towards like things like restaking, you know, projects that want to be ABSs naturally. There's also that. Plus, like a real economic use case for being a subDAO, which you get to request infinite amounts of DAI. Obviously, it needs to maintain the peg, you know, and whatever that looks like, be it a PSM or AMO future, needs to conform to that. And then I think there's also kind of like, you know, things about the PSM versus an AMO that are going to be included in the end game. I don't know what the timing or, you know, frankly, like final decision on that has been, but I think it's better to have it be a soft peg stablecoin. So I think there's a lot there. I also think like the AI focus is obviously going to be very zeitgeisty if Maker becomes this like AI chain and launching its own L1. Like a lot of the things that made coins popular, Rune is kind of internalized and put down on paper. And I totally, you know, understand people being either, you know, really pro Rune's leadership and guidance, or like frankly very anti Rune's leadership and guidance. My perspective is like, let Rune cook. Like we didn't buy Maker to like come in there and make all these political decisions and, you know, all that stuff. Like the founder is the founder is the founder, and he's like kind of the only person that can reaccelerate the trajectory of DAI. And obviously there's good and bad with that, but we're here for the ride, and I agree with the general plan as it stands. I don't think there's like too many other alternative plans that you could go after.
Yeah, I mean, when you say like let him cook, I mean, I agree with that. I think that this is one reason why, I mean, I had my own kind of proposal for what Maker should do. But when I saw that, I mean, for me, it was more important that kind of Maker has one coherent direction rather than, you know, that I'm right or that like my views are basically the ones that, you know, end up, you know, defining Maker's direction, right? And so, yeah, I think this is like the, if you had asked me like 2 years ago, okay, what's like the biggest problem in Maker, it's a lack of vision, right? And it's a lack of direction that kind of comes from that vision. And so, of course, I would have preferred a different vision, you know, it's like, but the fact that it has a vision, and the vision, as you say, is like, it is pretty coherent, I would say, like internally, that's good. Right, and that's like a big reason why, in spite of disagreeing with the vision, I'm still bullish on Maker, and like I'm still, you know, willing to invest in it and so on.
And I've read some of your posts from back in the day. Like it does seem like there was some shared vision of some sort at some point. And you know, turning off like core contributors is not what you want. Same time, that's kind of like life in the NFL. You know, it's like, strong-willed founder has a vision, like it is what it is. And kind of any way you slice it, behind ETH and Bitcoin and maybe Uniswap now, like Maker has the most amount of fees, and it has a path to, you know, triple, quadruple, maybe even 10x them if these subDAOs really do well. And I think a lot of it is like, how do you get the market to interpret this more favorably? Because, you know, the bigger the coin is, the better the chance you have, the more inflationary rewards, the more the subDAOs are worth. Like it has this whole like circular reflexive thing going. And I think if Rune does what he says he's going to do, it's going to work. That's my sense at least. And yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see over the years how these sub-DAOs do, because these are only the first five. You know, there's supposed to be a lot more. Like, imagine, you know, Maker incubates like a DA layer. You know, it's worth, these things are like worth like $20 billion now. It's like, okay, cool. We'll give those tokens away to DAI farmers. And, you know, maybe an L2 and maybe all, like, there's all these things that you can do if it's under the banner of Maker to incentivize DAI supply. And I don't think it's worth going after USDC head on and being like, we are a, you know, regulated, you know, blah, 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 whatever stablecoin. Like, I think of kind of Maker as kind of this cross between like this gigantic AI-driven hedge fund in the future, in the fullness of time, and a stablecoin. And I think that's okay. Like, the worst thing you can do is try to create like a USDC clone, like a PAX stablecoin that gets like, you know, $50 million in inflows. Like, that's just like not interesting. Like, let's try to do something different. That's my perspective. And Endgame, whatever you think of it, is extraordinarily either different or strange or like very compelling. But I think it's like pretty cool. So, you know, we're bullish.
Whatever happened to the idea of like forking the SVM and using that for the Endgame? Like, is that still on the table? I'm not completely caught up, so just curious there.
Changes like daily, you know, depends on who you ask. But I think it's like Maker having its own chain is in the future, probably like a couple years away. If it's SVM or if it's, you know, something else based, we'll see. Yeah.
Okay, so it seems that there's, or you believe that there's like a lot of the, let's say, maybe I need to say before I say anything else that not financial advice and don't trust me, but like, so maybe you're saying that in the future, like more of the valuation will drive from like this flywheel type of action instead of like currently where revenue and profits are super high because like the revenue isn't that cyclical right now, and then RWAs have been a big driver. So do you think that will flip where like now I guess Maker is seen as one of these dino coins from DeFi 1.0, and then the market will at some point realize that, okay, now this thing is getting interesting and we should just like buy the token?
I mean, you know, like the flywheel and then the branding are the two things. Celestia has like $75 a day in DA fees, and it's valued at $20 billion. Maker has, you know, $120 million of earnings per year, and it's valued at $2 billion. So it's just about changing the market's perception of that. And, you know, Maker's too expensive and the name is weird. So we need to change that. And so, like, I think you can think of it as, where are the fundamentals going? You know, that's going to be driven by Endgame. And then what is the multiple expansion going to be driven by? It's probably like the redenomination and branding. And these are not things that are native to crypto. You know, Tesla has done so many stock splits. Companies have changed their name and rebranded many times. I think this is like a well-worn playbook, frankly.
Yeah, I think kind of what's unique to this transition to the Endgame plan is that you kind of have like this, you know, spin-off or divestiture of, you know, these pieces of Maker. And they're kind of like focused on very specific verticals, in the money markets with Spark and the RWA side with these other two new RWA focused sub-DAOs. So if you want to kind of participate in those communities, it's much easier to do so and kind of find where you're going to go. You know, on the flip side, like, yeah, you need to own like DAI or MKR to participate in that new value creation. And I think that's something that a lot of people haven't really understood yet so far. One of the things we've kind of tried to do in this report is kind of lay out like the tokenomics as they stand today in the Maker Atlas. So for sub-DAOs, you know, you start with 4.6 billion token supply, 600 million is for, you know, the workforce team. The rest of the 4 billion is completely emitted through the farms. So, you know, 70% of that 4 billion is going to DAI farmers, 30% to MKR farmers. That's emitted over 10 years. Heavily front-end weighted, so $1 billion the first 2 years, $1 billion each year for the first 2 years, then goes down by half every 2 years until the last 4 years, which is the same emission rate. I think a lot of people haven't really done the math on kind of how that'll impact the Maker ecosystem. You know, frankly, like, Vance was like really one of the few people that actually like mentioned that to me, as, you know, like, I spend a ton of time on Maker. And I don't think everyone that owns Maker obviously has the time to do that, but you know, especially if you're, you know, looking at allocating capital in the space, you need to understand like what's going on with these DAOs. It's easy to kind of focus on like the new hot things and the, you know, super high value valuations of stuff like Celestia. But there's a ton of interesting things going on in like DeFi 1.0 tokens that I think people need to pay attention to. And that's kind of one of the things that we wanted to do with this report, is kind of show some of the exciting things, provide some more visibility, hopefully make it a little more digestible than the, you know, pure documentation that exists in the Maker governance forums. So hopefully, this is a step in the right direction.
One thing that I just think about as an investor, like the redenomination, the lock staking, the start of the Maker inflationary rewards, probably sometime this summer. Like, I think that's like a major catalyst for people to wake up and realize this. But the other one is the Spark airdrop that's happening in May. And I think they're airdropping 2% of their supply at some point in May. And it's highly possible that the Spark token FDV is worth roughly the same amount as Maker when it comes out. And like, you know, you think about it and it's like, okay, well, they're going to give all these tokens to Maker holders. So like, you should probably just add that expected value into your Maker valuation, whatever you think it's worth. But I think all of this starts relatively soon. And it's been a plan that's been 2 years in the making. Probably it's going to take longer than people think, but it's going to start being hard to ignore in the same sense that if you're holding a TIA and you get Dimension airdrops, like, you're just baking that into the cake of what you think it's worth.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, but I do agree with Hasu in terms of like needing to actually ignite like organic demand for the stablecoin. Like, do you guys think maybe it's important for DAI to expand natively like on L2s, or like what is the path forward for igniting that organic demand as opposed to just medium to maybe slightly longer term given the inflation schedule? But you know, when you throw tokens in the mix, it's ultimately not people who are there to stay.
Yeah, so I'd say that, you know, the organic demand is like literally the greatest challenge for anyone operating a stablecoin, and you've seen tons of new stablecoins over the past, you know, year or two, many backed by, you know, blue chip protocols or teams that have completely failed to gain any traction. You know, DAI is kind of like an incumbent early mover, has somewhat of a structural advantage over those. And there's no like easy answer to generating organic demand. It can come in like a ton of different ways. You know, one thing that DAI and Maker is trying to do is with the turning on of the DSR. So the DSR is, you know, above zero and actually at a relatively, you know, attractive rate. You know, people want to kind of integrate that into the, you know, DeFi Lego stack. So yeah, some people don't lock DAI and DSR directly, but if you want to, you know, earn a spread even above the DSR, you can put that in a lending protocol, a money market protocol, and earn even higher than the DSR. We want, you know, DAI to be broadly integrated everywhere. And that includes, you know, L2s. You know, the big idea is that basically, you know, heavily incentivize integrating the DSR everywhere as much as possible. This is kind of like a broad strategy to accomplish that.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the biggest low-hanging fruit for sure is like replacing DAI with SDAI. So, I mean, this is the one thing where DAI would be actually differentiated from USDC and USDT, because those are not, I mean, those, you can get a yield on those that's comparable, but you can't get it on chain, you know, while holding the asset in a liquid way. So I think this is one thing. Then obviously, I mean, how come, you know, you can't easily bridge DAI between different chains? You know, why is that not possible? Why is it not possible for me to mint DAI from collateral on other chains? You know, why is it possible to borrow it into existence from any chain? Why isn't there like a zero fee way of teleporting like DAI, like transferring DAI, like a PayPal like solution to like pay people with DAI at like no fee? Because it's like recorded in like Maker's internal ledger, etc. Right? There's like a million things you can do. Why aren't there any pairs like denominated against DAI in DeFi or in CeFi or whatever? Right? It's like, why is there so few things that I can do with it? And this is really like speaks to what I meant earlier, which is the demand side for DAI is the much more challenging one. And it needs a lot of active attention and investment in a very intelligent way in order to grow this. Because yes, you can kind of do these inorganic growth initiatives. Like you can, you know, try to create kind of reasons, you know, for people to hold DAI to farm something. But every farm eventually runs out of incentives. And this is not something that you can keep going forever, right? And so when you like take the 5 to 10 year look on Maker, then you realize, you know, the inorganic things, yes, they can, it can kind of be like, you know, raising yourself up on your own boots, like on your own bootstraps, because like money is a network effect, and with network effect, like the network is the value, right? And so maybe when there's more supply, it automatically is more useful to people. I think that's possible, but there's also all of these other features, you know, really where DAI has the ability to differentiate and like make a more useful network that people can like use in different ways. And I think this is where I would like to see much more focus in like the next 1 to 2 years, instead of kind of this inward focus. Hey, like, let's change the way that like our team is organized. It's like almost this in a startup where like the startup wastes, you know, all of its time like rewriting basically like their software stack for 2 years, right? And it's like, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't end up matter because there's like another startup that like grows 10 times quicker at the time because they're focused on users and creating value. And yeah, I mean, maybe they are like a worse software stack, but it doesn't end up mattering because they grow to a size where all of a sudden like the team that was so inwardly focused can no longer catch up. And I think that is the number one risk for Maker. It's like none of the other things. It's like Maker just being kind of too slow to focus on users and like grow to a size where kind of its network effect can kind of carry itself.
I agree with some of that, disagree with some of that. I do think like I think of it in terms of milestones. Like I would argue the reason Tether is so dominant is because Tether is so dominant. It just has a natural network effect of money. And, you know, the more of it there is, the more dominant you can be. And, you know, the more dominant that can propel you to potentially become. And I think step one is like, let's get to like 15 to 20 billion at DAI.
Yeah.
And I think if these sub DAOs do really, really well, we can get there. And like, you can like imagine it. You can kind of see it. It's like, you know, there's 15 billion at DAI. They're earning 6% on it. That's 900 million of revenue. That's 600 million of earnings. They're buying back the token, it's going really well. The sub DAOs are worth a lot. And, you know, obviously we're going to need to figure out what happens after the sub DAO emissions have after that first couple of years. But like, you know, in life, you kind of just, you knock out problems as they come. And, you know, maybe DAI supply crashes from, you know, 15 billion to 10 billion, but like you have the chance to be more dominant at that scale than you do at five. And yeah, I mean, it's so hard to tell why, you like, I think about USDC going forward and like, I kind of think they're in trouble. Tether, I think, is a solid number one. But I think the race for number two is much more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, Tether, you will never like replicate Tether because it's just like Tether is like all time, like top 10 business.
Right. It's never going
it's like so insane. I mean, the way that, I mean, but this speaks to like what DAI has to be doing against USDC, right? Like Tether is what DAI should have been in many ways. It's like this coin that basically created this huge network effect inside China and basically was like this trade to circumvent capital controls, right? And so in many ways, it's the decentralized stablecoin, and it like wins in a way that a decentralized stablecoin should win against a centralized stablecoin. Like DAI should go where USDC can't. And Tether is doing that right now. And like, it's not clear to me that there's room like long-term for another decentralized stablecoin, like not the way that it's like working right now. Right? And this is, I think, the big, like DAI is in the middle, like stuck in the middle right now between like USDC and like the highly, I mean, USDC's endgame is to become like the US CBDC, right? It's like, it's just to pivot into like a government coin. And USDT's endgame is basically to be this decentralized stablecoin that's like ungovernable, right? And what's the room for DAI, you know, between like this very centralized and this very decentralized? And I think this is I see the end game and I see, hey, it's like a better vision than it was 2 years ago. But still, it's not clear to me that it's like a long-term defensible competitive position.
I think they've got like some tools in their backpack, whatever you want to call it. They got the sub-DAOs, they got the lending facility. I think they've got the continued growth of crypto derivatives as something that, like, look, if funding rates are spiking and Maker can just allocate DAI to something like an Athena where they don't sell the DAI, it's just like kind of like this natural backstop. Like, there's a few different alleyways for them, or a few different pockets of growth for them to pursue. And I kind of think like USDC is just going to get picked apart by like the Ondos of the world and the Tethers of the world. And like, I would say they're more in the middle versus something like DAI, which is pretty small, has all these kind of like weird levers that it can pull, and it has like a lot of potential to grow. I think like USDC, they've had some inflows recently, but like they're kind of still in trouble in my mind. And the difference between USDC and DAI is that when interest rates go to zero, USDC has no revenue. DAI has, you know, all the crypto loans that they can provision. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, but I don't necessarily disagree with you. I think the prognosis is positive for Maker just because they have these tools in their pocket.
I think that's actually not true. I mean, DAI, so USDC benefits the exact same way from leverage, from like demand to borrow against crypto. It's just that like in Maker, it happens kind of in a more direct way because people can directly deposit in the Maker protocol and borrow like DAI into existence from that. And for USDC, there's just one interim step through kind of an arbitrage trade, because when like the demand to borrow USDC from Aave against crypto, for example, goes up, then that again puts like pressure to mint more USDC, and USDC can basically charge money on kind of the, let's say, you know, the creation of that or something. You know, it's I think USDC still benefits. It's like, but I agree. I mean, DAI basically has to find a way to differentiate and like to have some kind of unique strategy. And to me, it would make a lot of sense that it has to do something with DeFi. And maybe like the rules tighten around DeFi. I'm not even sure that that's bad for DAI, just maybe because it like raises the hurdles for USDC more than it does for DAI. I kind of don't believe it the way that kind of the regulation is trending in Europe and the US. So I think it's more probably going to be like pretty good for DeFi. But yeah, definitely needs to find some things that you can do with DAI that are more difficult to do with USDC.
All right, I know we're up on time on the calendar, so I do want to round this out. But does anyone have any closing thoughts, any bold predictions for MakerDAO throughout the course of the rest of this year that they want to share?
I'll leave the predictions to Vance.
Dude, I think my compliance officer would kill me if I started throwing out predictions, so I'm going to probably sit this one out. But yeah, I mean, like we're positive on Maker and DAI, and I think, you know, whenever Endgame launches, it's going to be kind of the first time that we can really even tell what's going on. But from the rough schematics, I think it's going to be very positive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm you wouldn't believe it probably when you just hear me, you know, talk about Maker for an hour, but I'm very positive about Maker compared to like most other things in crypto. The reason I'm critical is because I'm afraid that Maker is kind of squandering some of its like enormous potential. Because decentralized stablecoin, that is still the number one killer use case in crypto. Like in spite of a lot of other things that you're seeing, this is like Bitcoin and Ether, they are trying to be money. But like, do you know what is already like the kind of biggest adoption money in the world? That's the US dollar. And Bitcoin will never break that. Like that's never gonna happen. And neither is Ether. So the demand for USDC, for USD will always eclipse kind of the demand for these more volatile cryptocurrencies that are really like more kind of the gold, I think, of the digital age, rather than kind of the money that people use to save and transact. And so, and with the world kind of becoming less, you know, globalist in a sense, and like more kind of separating into like smaller pockets that maybe don't have the kind of cooperation of kind of the Pax Hegemon area that we are kind of coming from, the ability to have this shared, you know, medium of exchange I think is still enormous, right? So the potential for a decentralized stablecoin is enormous. That's why I would rather own, like, you know, 1% of Tether than virtually anything else, right? And I think DAI, like, nobody can get like a piece of Tether, but like you can get a piece of Maker. And I think that is still the bull case, that like DAI can somehow manage to basically become the Tether 2.0.
Leave it there.
Yeah, that was a good mic drop. All right, guys, thanks so much for coming on. I'll be sure to drop links to your socials in the show notes. And Mark, I will definitely drop the link to the Stakehouse report, which everyone should read. It, like we said in the beginning, it is super comprehensive. Unfortunately, we weren't able to really pick it apart super deeply on this podcast as was originally intended, but hopefully you have a better idea of the end game now, and that will assist in your reading. But fans, Hasu, Mark, thanks for coming on. We'll see you next time.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for watching today's ZeroX Research episode. I wanted to take a second and remind you about our upcoming 2024 Digital Asset Summit in London this March. Seats are limited, so hit the link in the description and use the promo code 0x10 to save 10% on tickets. See you in London.